Okay, so picture this. It's 1924. The jazz is hot, the gin is cold, and in Chicago, murder is. Well, it's basically a form of entertainment.
It really was.
And if you're a woman who just, shot her lover, you don't really need a lawyer.
No, you need a press agent.
Exactly. And that's what we're unpacking today. We're getting into the machinery behind Chicago. Not just the songs, but the actual 1926 play. It's based on a play about real killings that somehow became this definitive satire of the American justice system.
It is such a wild transformation. We're looking at a whole stack of sources here. Biographies of Bob Fosse, of course, production logs from both the 70s and the 90s, and even the original reporting from the Chicago Tribune.
And the mission for this deep dive, I think, is to answer a pretty specific question.
Yeah.
How did a show that was considered like too cynical and too dark in the 1970s come back 20 years later and become the longest running American musical in Broadway history?
It's a huge question. Because it really is a tale of two different eras. You have the 1975 production, which it was fine, a modest success.
Right, but it was totally in the shadow of A Chorus Line.
Completely. And then you have the 1996 revival, which just exploded.
It did. But to really get why the culture finally caught up to the show, we have to start way, way back.
With the source material?
Because Roxy Hart and Velma Kelly were not just characters, they were real women.
They absolutely were. And the woman who made them famous, Maureen Dallas Watkins, she wasn't a playwright to begin with.
No, she was a reporter.
A reporter for the Chicago Tribune. In 1924, she gets assigned to the courthouse beat, specifically to cover what they called row murders.
Which were crimes committed by women.
That's it. And I mean, she basically struck gold right away with two particular cases.
So let's look at the real Roxy Hart first. In the show, she's this sort of wide-eyed, maybe slightly sociopathic wannabe vaudevillian.
Right.
But the real woman, Beulah Annan, was, I don't know, maybe even more unnerving.
I'd say so. Beulah was 23, accused of shooting her lover, a man named Harry Kelstedt. He was the model for Fred Casely.
And in the musical, you see Roxy panic and try to get her husband Amos to take the fall.
Yes, but the police reports on Beulah Annan, they paint a much, much colder picture.
This is the one detail from the notes that I just can't get out of my head. After she shot him, she didn't call the police. She didn't even call her husband right away.
Right.
She sat there for 2 hours while he lay dead on the floor. And she's drinking cocktails and playing a foxtrot record called Hulaloo over and over again.
It's just chilling. It's a level of detachment that Foss, later tried to capture in the choreography. It's like she was watching her own life as if it were a movie.
Okay, so then you've got the model for Velma Kelly.
Belva Gertner.
Right. And she was already a bit of a name, a cabaret simmer.
A society divorcee, yeah. The police find her lover dead in her car, and right there with him is a bottle of gin and a pistol.
And her defense was just classic 1920s Chicago.
Oh, totally. She claims she blacked out. She told the police, "I heard a shot, but I don't remember shooting him." She just leaned entirely on her charm and her, confusion.
And this brings us to a really crucial idea in the notes, which is the Sob Sisters. It
Yes.
sounds like a derogatory term, but these female reporters were actually shaping the entire narrative of the city.
That's exactly right. It was a media war. Watkins' paper, the Tribune, was generally pro-prosecution. But the Hearst papers, they employed these Sob Sisters.
And their job was what
Not
exactly?
and find the emotional angle. They focused on the defendant's beauty, their fashion, their tragic backstories. They were turning murder trials into daily soap operas.
So the question for the jury wasn't really, did she pull the trigger? It was more like,
Is she pretty enough to forgive?
wow.
Yeah. There was this belief, they called it Cook County lore, that an attractive woman just could not be convicted of murder in Chicago.
And it worked.
It worked. Both Beulah Annan and Belva Gartner were acquitted, days apart.
So Maureen Dallas Watkins sees all of this go down. She turns her columns into a play in 1926, and it's a hit. But here's the twist. For decades, she refused to let anyone turn it into a musical. Bob Fosse, the legend himself, is knocking on her door in the 60s, and she just keeps saying no.
She had a huge change of heart later in life. A lot of historians think she became deeply religious and really regretted that her writing had glamorized these
Just
killers.
felt like she helped them get away with it.
Exactly. She felt she had helped them escape justice. So she blocked the rights until she died in 1969.
Which is, I mean, the musical Chicago only exists because the creator of the original play passed away.
The irony is just baked into its creation.
So Watkins dies, The estate sells the rights, and Foss finally gets his wish. He teams up with John Kander and Fred Ebb.
And this is where the genius of the adaptation really comes in. They didn't just want to tell the story of Roxy and Velma. They wanted to replicate the feeling of that media circus.
So they came up with the concept of a musical vaudeville.
That's the key.
We should probably dig into that structure, because it's not just like an aesthetic choice. It's the whole argument of the show.
It is. A vaudeville show was a variety show. You know,
okay.
A juggler, then a singer, then a comedian. By framing the musical that way, they're saying the justice system is just one big distracting series of acts.
The metaphor is literally that justice and show business are the same thing.
Precisely. And every single character is modeled on a famous vaudeville archetype.
Mm-hmm.
Roxy was based on Helen Morgan, a torch singer. The lawyer, Billy Flynn, he was modeled on Ted Lewis.
And matron Mama Morton is pure Sophie Tucker.
Uh-huh. But it goes beyond just the character types. It's the staging. Foss directed and choreographed it to be Brechtian.
Okay, that's a term that gets thrown around a lot in theater. What does it mean for Chicago specifically?
Right. So Bertolt Brecht's whole philosophy was that theater shouldn't let you just get lost in the story. It should constantly remind you that you are watching a performance.
It's about implicating the audience.
Yes. In Chicago, the characters are constantly breaking the fourth wall. They talk right to you. They treat the audience like the jury.
So by doing that, they make us complicit.
Totally. When Billy Flynn sings Razzle Dazzle, he's looking right at you, telling you he's going to trick you. And you applaud him for it. You become part of the corruption.
Speaking of Razzle Dazzle, there's a fantastic little detail about the collaboration between Ebb and Foss. The song has that iconic...
The double snap.
The double snap in the rhythm.
That was Fred Ebb's idea. He knew Foss's style was all about that minimalist, precise movement. So he told Kander to put a double snap in the music because, he said, Bobby will love that.
And he did.
He was right. Fossey heard it and immediately built the whole number around it. It's just a perfect example of how the music and the movement were created in total lockstep.
Okay, so they have this brilliant concept. They have a powerhouse cast, Gwen Verdon, Chita Rivera, Jerry Orbach. The show opens in June 1975, and it's not the smash hit they expected.
Not at all. It did okay, but the reviews were really mixed. And you have to remember the context of 1975. The country is just coming out of Watergate.
Vietnam is ending.
The national mood is already pretty grim.
And here comes Chicago telling them, hey, everything's corrupt, everyone's a liar, and murderers are the real heroes.
It was just too cynical. And to make matters worse, it opened against a chorus line.
The ultimate feel-good musical.
Right. A chorus line is about how hard people work for their dreams. It's full of heart.
And Chicago is about how people lie and cheat for fame.
So a chorus line just swept the Tonys, sold out for years, and Chicago became the also-ran. It closed after about 2 years.
So now let's fast forward 20 years.
Yeah.
May 1996.
Wow.
The City Center Encore series decides to do a concert version of Chicago. And for people who don't know, Encores isn't a full production.
Not at all. It's usually actors with scripts in hand, basically no set, minimal rehearsal.
So they stripped everything away. No 1920s period sets, no colorful flapper costumes.
The actors just wore black dancewear. And the orchestra was right on stage in this giant jury box. Walter Bobby directed it. And Anne Ranking, who was Foss's muse and partner, she came back to choreograph in his style.
And this stripped-down, bare-bones version moves to Broadway and becomes an absolute monster hit, wins 6 Tonys. It's still running today.
Still going.
So the million-dollar question is, why? Why did the exact same material that felt too dark in 1975 feel so perfect in 1996?
Well, the easy answer is that the production itself was just so sleek and sexy. But the deeper answer, I think, is cultural.
I have a theory on this, and it really points to one specific event. If you look at the timeline, the revival explodes in 96. What had America just spent the entire previous year watching on TV?
The O.J. Simpson trial.
Exactly. We had just watched the real-life version of Billy Flynn. We saw the dream team of celebrity lawyers. We saw the media circus. We saw the narrative being manipulated live every single day.
You're actually right. I mean, in 1975, the idea that a lawyer would turn a murder trial into a tap dance, that felt like satire.
But in 1996.
In 1996, it felt like a documentary.
And I think the minimalism of the revival played a huge role in that, too. By taking away all the 1920s costumes and sets, they sort of, they removed the distance.
That is such a key point. Because when you have the big period sets, the audience can sit back and say, oh, look at those crazy people in the roaring 20s.
Right. It's historical. It's not about us.
But when you strip it down to black clothes and a spotlight, it looks modern. It looks like today. and the corruption feels timeless.
Let's actually look at the mechanics of that corruption in the plot, because the show is really a how-to guide for manipulating public opinion.
For sure. You have the cell block tango, where the women all justify their murders.
Yep.
But the real turning point is when Billy Flynn takes over.
Billy Flynn is the engine of the whole show.
He is. And his philosophy is stated right out loud. I don't care about the truth. I care about the story.
And the number, "We both reached for the gun," is the perfect visualization of this. It's the press conference scene.
Right. And Fosse staged it as a ventriloquist act. Billy sits Roxy on his lap like a dummy. He controls her mouth. He literally sings the answers for her.
And the reporters are like marionettes dancing on his strings.
It's terrifying when you really think about it. He is constructing her reality in real time.
Yeah.
And the press is just transcribing it without question.
Then in Act Two, he just doubles down with Razzle Dazzle. He tells Roxy it doesn't matter if she's guilty as long as she's entertaining.
Even the old hocus pocus.
Yeah.
It's the thesis statement of the whole show.
We can't talk about the manipulation without mentioning Amos, though. Roxy's husband.
Yeah.
The guy who actually pays for the lawyer.
Oh, poor Amos. Mr. Cellophane.
Yeah.
He represents the truth. He's the only honest person in the entire show, and because of that, he's invisible.
Billy Flynn just uses him as a prop, invents a fake pregnancy for Roxy to get sympathy, and Amos just goes along with it because he's so desperate to be seen.
The cynicism is just relentless.
And the ending, I mean, usually in a musical, justice is served or there's some kind of moral lesson.
Not here. In Chicago, Roxy and Velma are acquitted.
They get off scot-free.
But here's the kicker. The second the verdict is read, the press loses all interest. They all run out of the courtroom because some other woman just shot her husband down the street.
Their fame just evaporates instantly.
So what do? They realize, well, since we can't be famous for the murder anymore, we have to monetize the notoriety.
They team up.
The double act. Roxy and Velma, the two killer dillers, they form a vaudeville act. They sing nowadays. They take their flowers. They take their bows.
Sail upward.
It's the ultimate indictment of celebrity culture. You commit a crime, you get famous, you get, you know, a reality show. Or in this case, a vaudeville tour.
And that final image is so powerful. They're throwing flowers to the audience, thanking us for our belief in their innocence.
But we know they're guilty.
Mm-hmm.
They know we know. But we're all clapping anyway because they put on such a good show.
Which brings us all the way back to Maureen Dallas Watkins, the reporter who started all of this. We said earlier she refused to let the show be made because she regretted glamorizing these women.
She did. She wanted their names to just fade away.
But the great irony is, because of this musical, Roxy Hart and Velma Kelly are immortal. They are icons.
That's the paradox of Chicago, isn't it? It's a satire that critiques how we turn criminals into celebrities. But in doing so, it became the most successful vehicle for turning criminals into celebrities that Broadway has ever seen.
So did the show critique the culture, or did it just perfect the packaging?
That's the question I ask myself every time I see it. You realize We are the audience Foss was warning us about.
A sobering thought to end on, despite all that jazz. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.
Always a pleasure.
We'll see you next time.